For Pacifica Radio and Planet Waves FM, welcome to the Miracle Hour. My name is Eric Francis Coppolino, the editor of Planet Waves, here with the fourth edition of our program today. I am planning to cover the Course in Miracles Manual for Teachers. As you may know, this is a weekly program that is devoted to understanding and thinking about and applying the stuff, information, whatever it might be, in A Course in Miracles. This is one of the, you might think of as the seminal New Age texts that came out around 1976 or so, and has been, I think, profoundly influential in the New Age and New Consciousness movements, although it is it's a work that many people resist for good reasons, I think, one of them being that the language is a barrier. It's somewhat religious in tone, and in addition, the whole thing is written with male pronouns. And I wonder if we didn't have those male pronouns and the tone were slightly less religious, whether it would be more accessible to people. That, in any event, is what I am here to do. As I've mentioned in previous programs, this is a critical reading of the materials, as well as my sharing some experiences and stories from my personal journey with A Course in Miracles. Music today, as ever, will be by Vision Quest. That's the ensemble that I work with that grew out of the 2016 annual project of Planet Waves, also called Vision Quest. So I've got three pieces selected, and not including the intro music, and that piece, by the way, is called Magic Carpet. So let's talk a bit about the Manual for Teachers. Course in Miracles has in it somewhere the idea, in these words, that everyone teaches and teaches all the time. Now, this is not normal teaching of the world. Usually we think that we're always trying to figure things out, and that we don't really have much of a role in teaching. That's reserved for, you know, people with their K-12 license, or who teach in private school, or who are professors, or who are music teachers, or something like that. But when we consider the idea that everyone teaches and teaches all the time, that can be potentially informative, particularly since we're not in a classroom all the time. We're not sitting in front of a microphone talking to an audience about a topic. In fact, most people don't do that at all. The moments when they teach are rare. Most of it, I think, involves our children teaching them things. But the Course in Miracles has a different concept, at least proposes a different concept of teaching, which is that we teach by the example that we set. And that the words that we say don't actually matter so much as what we demonstrate to others. And if you watch the world for a while and you watch the way in which people so generously imitate one another, that imitation is really another way of saying teaching by example. This can be as simplistic as a guitar player you like plays a certain kind of guitar, and you try that one out because you like what the person does, but really what you're doing is you're following an example. Or I was listening to some political pundits interviewing people in, I think it was in South Carolina, where the Democratic caucus happened over the weekend, and someone said, well, I was going to vote for so-and-so, but since Trump is winning, I'm going to vote for Trump. And so wanting to play for the side that's winning or cheer for the side that's winning is another example of teaching by example. And I would encourage you to look at this phenomenon. Look at the way in which children imitate adults. Adults imitate each other. The entire culture tends to imitate certain few people who are put in a position of authority. Indeed, we choose people to set an example for us, and we kind of choose them as exemplars. They're often called politicians, but really we're choosing based on the example that we want set. And there's all kinds of issues mingled into this, like mommy and daddy issues, of needing the parental figure to imitate, and then we kind of choose one or elect one for ourselves. And I think it's good to be conscious about this. A Course in Miracles takes it straight up. You open the package up, at least back in the old days. Now the books were contained in one volume, but when they were in three volumes, it was even more obvious to see that one was a textbook and one was a workbook, and then one was the manual for teachers, the thinnest one. But still, you're beginning this thing and know very little about it, presumably. And then in the original set of materials, you're given a teaching manual. You're given a thing that's supposed to help you, you know, basically set an example in the world. So I want to look at some of the language in the teacher's manual, and I think if we even get up to just the introduction, we've made some pretty good progress. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to read you the introduction, and I'll insert my commentary. Hopefully you can tell the difference between when I'm commenting and when I am reading. But anyway, you open the book up, and there's an introduction, and the introduction begins, "The role of teaching and learning in the world is actually reversed in the thinking of the world. The reversal is characteristic. It seems as if the teacher and the learner are separated, and the teacher giving something to the learner rather than to himself. Further, the act of teaching is regarded as a special activity in which one engages only a relatively small proportion of one's time. The course, on the other hand, emphasizes that to teach is to learn, so the teacher and the learner are the same. It also emphasizes that teaching is a constant process. It goes on every moment of the day and continues into sleeping thoughts as well." Okay, that's the first paragraph. The idea of reversal is pretty important in The Course in Miracles. The statement's made a number of times that we're basically seeing everything upside down, and that we've got many very important things backwards. And if you haven't noticed that about the world, I don't really know what there is to notice. We could notice it in the world as the rich thinking they need more money, and therefore they should take it from poor people. There's an example. In reality, it would be great if we could, you know, even take 5% of the resources of the 1% and quote unquote redistribute them a little bit more. But it seems as if the small people like to cheer for the big ones, and we would rather have a billionaire be president than a public servant of some kind. It's a strange thing. So these reversals are all over the place. You don't need to look far to see them. But the problem is we think that they're normal. And when you start noticing the reversals, you start to see quite a few. Okay, let's continue with the text here. Text of the Manual for Teachers. "To teach is to demonstrate. There are only two thought systems, and you demonstrate that you believe one or the other is true all the time. From your demonstration, others learn, and so do you. The question is not whether you teach, for in that there is no choice. The purpose of the course might be said to provide you with the means of choosing what you want to teach on the basis of what you want to learn. You cannot give to someone else, but only to yourself, and this you learn through teaching. Teaching is but a call to witness, to attest to what you believe. It is a method of conversion. This is not done by words alone. Any situation must be to you a chance to teach others what you are and what they are to you." no more than that, but also never less. End of paragraph. Okay, so to teach is to demonstrate, that's pretty easy to follow. You might watch the way that your music teacher sits and holds the instrument, even though they don't tell you that. And imitation is one of the first ways anyone learns anything at all, whether it's language or playing patty cake. Next sentence. There are two thought systems. There are only two thought systems. And you demonstrate that you believe one or the other is true all the time. Now, this is another central idea in A Course in Miracles, that basically we can orient our entire mental and emotional kind of scenario around fear or around love. And that is what this means when they say there's only two thought systems. From your demonstration, others learn, and so do you. The question is not whether you will teach, for in that there is no choice. The purpose of the course might be said to provide you with the means for choosing what you want to teach on the basis of what you want to learn. Really interesting. This is me, not it. That choosing what you want to teach on the basis of what you want to learn is a way to organize your life. It is a way to put all your other priorities into place. Because everything kind of falls in around the choice of what you want to teach based on what you want to learn. Next sentence. You cannot give to someone else, but only to yourself. And this you learn through teaching. So I've personally found this to be pretty, you know, amazing. I, in my work, do a lot of teaching. I consider writing to be a form of education, no matter what. I work with the staff all day long, and how I treat the people I work with is in itself a form of teaching. And ultimately, I am the recipient and the beneficiary of that teaching, right? Because when I write a beautiful article, it certainly does benefit the world, but in the end, I learn something by doing that. And even that one value, even the value of doing what you do to learn, rather than as an expression of some pre-existing mastery. Oh, I know how to do that. Don't worry, I'll do it. That's a different attitude than approaching something that maybe you've seen many times before as if it were a new puzzle of some kind, a new experiment that you are that you're doing, and set the goal of learning rather than, you know, for example, mastering. The Grateful Dead have a great line from the song Terrapin Station, which maybe I'll play sometime. But the line is, the storyteller makes no choice. Soon you will not hear his voice. His job is to shed light and not to master. Teaching is but a call to witness, to attest to what you believe, says A Course in Miracles. It is a method of conversion. I find that an interesting statement. This is a very subtle form of conversion, because this is not the, yo, do you accept Jesus? Right now, tell me. We're not talking about that. We're talking about, hello, I'm showing up for you, and I'm here to teach A Course in Miracles, but I'm also here to teach consistency, right? If I come back every week and do my program, that in itself is teaching. Doesn't matter what I say. If I show up, and how much of life is showing up? And so the example of people who show up with a clear mind, ready to work. That's a very helpful form of teaching. Continues, this is not done by words alone. Any situation must be to you a chance to teach others what you are and what they are to you. No more than that, but also never less. Any situation must be to you a chance to teach others what you are and what they are to you. I think the two most important operative words here are any situation. One of the, I think, really great teachings in A Course in Miracles, and it's applied through, you know, these lessons, nothing I see means anything, and I've given everything I see all the meaning that it has for me, are aimed at generalizing that nothing is really special, that every situation and any situation are fundamentally alike, distinguished only by the purpose that we assign them. Okay, one more paragraph, and then we'll listen to a song. The curriculum you set up is therefore determined exclusively by what you think you are and what you believe the relationship of others is to you. The curriculum you set up is therefore determined exclusively by what you think you are and what you believe the relationship of others is to you. In the formal teaching situation, these questions may be totally unrelated to what you think you're teaching. It is impossible not to use the content of any situation on behalf of what you really teach and therefore really learn. It is impossible not to use the content of any situation on behalf of what you really teach and therefore what you really learn. I've still got to parse that out a little bit. Let's take it a couple of sentences further. To this, the verbal content of your teaching is quite irrelevant. It may coincide with it, or it may not. It is the teaching underlying what you say that teaches you. Teaching but reinforces what you believe about yourself. Its fundamental purpose is to diminish self-doubt. This does not mean the self you're trying to protect is real, but it does mean the self you think is real is what you teach. I mean, so to use music instruction as an example, I may sit with Dan, as I've done now hundreds of times, and it may seem that what he is teaching me is, you know, how to play a sus4 chord. But really, what he's teaching me, for example, is that it's possible to learn. To give one example, that it's possible for him to be an evolving musician, just as I am an evolving musician. So the feeling tone, the showing up, and ultimately what we're conveying as the inherent meaning of music is really much more important version of what's being taught than, for example, the sus4 chord. It's interesting. This does not mean that the self you're trying to protect is real, but it does mean that the self you think is real is what you teach. This gets into the Holy Spirit versus the ego question that is pervasive in A Course in Miracles. I've got a lot to say about that, and may get into it in this edition, and certainly there will be room in future weeks to do this. Everyone who follows the world's curriculum, and everyone here does follow it until he changes his mind, teaches solely to convince himself that he is what he is not. Herein is the purpose of the world. What else then would its curriculum be? Into this hopeless and closed learning situation, which teaches nothing but despair and death, God sends his teachers, and they teach his lessons of joy and hope. As they teach his lessons of joy and hope, their learning finally becomes complete. Okay, so we've got a new idea introduced here, which is that somehow there's this entity called God, which we haven't really talked much about what that is. But we do see a property of this thing, which is that people are being chosen to enter the really harrowing, hopeless, helpless situation of the world and to offer some happy news. And I think that the happiest news is basically that, you know, you show up with positive vibes. According to what we're reading here, that pretty much would say it all. All right, so speaking of some positive vibes, here's a piece of music that we composed about 2 hours ago. Met with the brothers Daniel. We meet at noon on weekends. So today's recording on Sunday, and rearranged my schedule a bit this weekend, and so I've just freshly come from a recording session where we have used some new methods of recording. We laid this down in three different takes, and it's me on acoustic guitar, and Daniel Grimsland on bass, and Sternstein helping out on percussion, and also kind of keeping us organized, and also conducting. This is called, what's it called? I Should Have Known. Here you go. Bass and shakers and a little scrapey stick that you kind of rub on with a drumstick and get that percussive sound. One of the fun ways that the role of teaching and learning is being reversed in my music studies project is that I'm basically the kind of conceptual leader of this project, Vision Quest, but I'm working with my music teacher and another musician named Grimsland, and these guys have, you know, played hundreds and hundreds of shows and have been practicing since they were teenagers. I've been busy writing and taking pictures and traveling and things like that. And what's interesting is I am taking a lot of what I've learned in music study and then bringing it back into the recording process. For example, the idea of keeping it simple. And I Should Have Known is an example of keeping music really simple and working with very few elements and then gently and gradually building. as we do in life. All right, so there is one more paragraph in this introduction, and then we will move on to another section of the teacher's manual. Remembering that the mere inclusion of a teacher's manual in a course where you're just beginning is in itself a pretty powerful commentary. I mean, imagine if you showed up at university and instead of they're deciding whether you needed to take remedial English or not, or take 101 and 102, or could you place out of 101 and 102? They gave you you started also your first semester with a course on how to teach. That would be a big switch, right? That would change your orientation, and you might not think you were ready until you understood what ready meant. And I encourage you to teach anything that you know, partly so that you can pass it forward and partly so that you can consolidate your learning. One of the ways I learned astrology as fast as I did, and I did have 7 years of preparation, spiritual training and Course in Miracles therapy, working with divination methods and all that. But once I started to actually embrace the ideas and the language of astrology, it was only 1 year later that I was actually practicing professional and moved to the top of my field as a kind of idea maker, because I understood that that I would benefit from writing about what I was learning. And so I was able to concentrate a lot of learning really, really fast simply by writing about what I was doing. And that writing about is a form of teaching, and therefore it's a form of very condensed and concentrated learning. And I would say that if you have a subject that you really want to know, teach the subject and see what happens. The people who supposedly know less than you will teach you things that no one would have imagined, and that is the way that it works. And that role reversal is very helpful. Let's put it this way. If you go to university, the interesting professors are the ones who are still learning. The interesting professors, at least in my mind, are the ones where you can raise your hand and say something, and the professor thinks about it and says, wow, I never thought of it that way. And students coming up with this stuff all the time because their minds are not cluttered with, 20 years of, postdoctoral stuff and bureaucracy. They're just approaching subjects with a beginner's mind. And so the best teachers, I think, are the ones who stay in that state of beginner's mind because it's fun. All right, one last paragraph here. We're going to get into some more religious terminology, and I'm going to do my best to kind of break out what I think they're getting to. We still haven't talked about who God is, but let's say that for our purposes, God is like the conscious intelligence of the universe, not personified. It's something that's much more distributed as a kind of a resonance. You can almost think of it as you're standing in the Grand Canyon and you shout your name and you hear your name come back. That's not exactly the canyon walls addressing you personally, as it is you're hearing your reflection off of the canyon walls. No, now only imagine the canyon walls possess a degree of sentience and can tailor the message for you a little bit, because in a sense, they were aware of you before you were aware of them. There's my roundabout theory of God. Okay. Except for God's teachers, says Course in Miracles, there would be little hope of salvation. for the world of sin would seem forever real. So now we've introduced a new term. I'm not sure if we've heard the term salvation yet. And that I find to be one of the more, let's say, annoying Christian words. But we could substitute healing for salvation. It really means to be salvaged. And to be salvaged is to propose that we're kind of junk left behind. The reason salvation is an accurate word, with its implication of being salvaged, is because so many people feel like they have been trashed and left behind. And so it's quite possible that to some extent everyone has the feeling of having been trashed and left behind. I mean, not to mention the fact that we don't really know how we or any of this got here to this particular planet, you know, 25,000 light years from the center of the galaxy, floating around on a little speck of dust with lovely oceans. Okay, so salvation, to be saved in some way. The world of sin would seem forever real. Now, sin is a Latin root, and it means lack. The word sincere, sincerely yours, that one, that means without error. Sin means without, and error means sire or sire. I'm not sure how it's actually pronounced. But to say sincere means without error. So sin means lack, and you can translate the word sin into lack. Now, it has been made into something else by these Christian missionaries, shall we call them. And that is a form of having something that's really bad that you need to get rid of. And really, it's much simpler than that. It's the perception of lack and loss. So let's read this somewhat complex sentence again. Except for God's teachers, that's us, there would be little hope of salvation, for the world of sin would seem forever real. New sentence. The self-deceiving must deceive, for they teach deception. The self-deceiving must deceive, for they must teach deception. This is not as circular as it seems. Actually, I'm reading this as a pretty straightforward statement that that those who deceive themselves must... Okay, let's read it again. Let's see if I could parse this out and make it as simple as it seems to me. The self-deceiving must deceive, for they must teach deception. It's all one thing. To be self-deceiving, to deceive, and to teach deception are one thing. This isn't another way of saying, very different way of saying, that people cannot split their character. You basically teach truth, or you teach deception. And you choose which you teach. It's really, in my view, not possible to divide your character and to be a good guy part of the time and a terrible guy part of the time, even though it seems to be that way often. Okay. The self-deceiving must deceive, for they must teach deception. And what else is hell? Good point. This is a manual for the teachers of God. They're not perfect, or they would not be here. That's a very loaded statement, by the way. It's saying that we're here because we're not perfect. I personally don't accept that logic. I think there's more compassionate ways to state that, but let's just leave it at that. They're not perfect, or they would not be here. Yet it is their mission to become perfect here, and so they teach perfection over and over in many ways until they have learned it. So, perfection? I haven't looked that up in the etymology dictionary. And then they are seen no more, although their thoughts remain as a source of strength and truth forever. Who are they? Who are these teachers? How are they chosen? What do they do? How can they work out their own salvation and the salvation of the world? Question mark. Again, I wish there was a better word because it's been so trodden upon. But let's just let that stand for a while and try not to let the language get in the way too much. Jeez, I am an editor. I think almost everything can be better written. This manual attempts to answer those questions. So how can we work out our own healing and the healing of the world? This manual attempts to answer those questions. It's a very short volume, and it's relatively simple compared to the other ones. And then it moves into a clarification of terms. Some cool stuff in here. Let's check out a couple of these paragraphs. And here's where you get out of where I can get out of worrying about some of these words I don't like very much. This is not a course in philosophical speculation, nor is it concerned with precise terminology. It is only concerned with atonement or correction of perception. Okay, so now we have a definition of atonement, which I've said previously to me is at one meant, or the correction of perception. So here's a very distinct definition of atonement. The means of the atonement is forgiveness. The structure of, quote, individual consciousness, unquote, is essentially irrelevant because it is a concept representing the, quote, original error, unquote, or the, quote, original sin, unquote. To study the error itself does not lead to correction if you're indeed to succeed in overlooking the error. And it is just this process of overlooking at which the course aims. Okay, there's a lot in there. I'm trying to think back to the self that I was approximately 30 years ago in a couple of weeks, reading this stuff for the first time. I've never really thought about much of this. This is not a course in philosophical speculation, nor is it concerned with precise terminology. It is concerned with the atonement, or the correction of perception. The means of the atonement is forgiveness. The structure of individual consciousness, quotes, is essentially irrelevant because it is a concept representing the original error or the original sin. Okay, this is really a helpful thought in my opinion, because the structure of, quote, individual consciousness, you know, whether it's like, are you an ego, or are you a Holy Spirit, or are you a personality, or soul, or whatever, this statement is asserting that that is essentially irrelevant because it's a concept representing an original error. It's another form of the mistake to worry about the structure of individual consciousness, which you might think of as the personality, because it's extremely complex, and the self-definition, the self-limiting self-definition of individual consciousness is the mistake. I think this is about the idea that we're not actually connected to something much, much larger than ourselves at all times. Okay, so to study the error in itself does not lead to correction if you're indeed to succeed in overlooking the error, and it is just this process of overlooking the error at which this course aims. All terms are potentially controversial, and those who see controversy will find it. Yet those who see clarification will find it as well. They must, however, be willing to overlook controversy, recognizing that it is a defense against truth in the form of a delaying maneuver. Pause here. Yes, controversy is often a ruse. This is one reason why it is worth evaluating controversy as a ruse, as a distraction. And by the way, you may also notice that sometimes people have a tendency to make things controversial that are not really controversial, and the end result of so doing is a delay. Theological considerations as such are necessarily controversial, continues the text, since they depend on belief and can therefore be accepted or rejected. A universal theology is impossible, but a universal experience is not only possible but necessary. It is this experience toward which the course is directed. Here alone, consistency becomes possible, because here alone, uncertainty ends. I've noticed this about theology. It's, I think, one of the most laughable subjects because it's based on concepts of God that we have no particular validation of. I mean, so this would kind of like be doing any, you know, it would be like speculating about baseball when you have no concept of the rules of baseball. You could think the pitcher and the batter are on the same team. And from one viewpoint, they are on the same team because everyone's playing the same game. Okay. A universal theology is impossible, but a universal experience is not only possible, but necessary. I think the universal experience is we just care about each other and are willing to help each other. It is this experience toward which the course is directed. Here alone, consistency becomes possible, because here alone, uncertainty ends. That, by the way, is a syllogism that contrasts consistency with certainty. When uncertainty ends, consistency becomes possible. That's a powerful syllogism, that inconsistency is a product of uncertainty. And so there's a teaching-learning relationship between practicing some consistency and having some sense of certainty. Try that one on somewhere, sometime. All right, let's take another music break. This is a piece in 5, and it is called 5 Alive. Alive, trying to count in 5. Most music is counted in 4. 1, 2, 3, 4, or 1, 2, 3, 4. And when you're counting in 5, it's 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, or 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, depending on how you phrase it. And as you may have heard, it's actually not that easy, even for some pretty skilled percussionists. I'm not one of them, but they were in the room. All right. So I was thinking about this idea of consistency and certainty. And it occurred to me that there is a sub-theme here, or possibly even a dominant theme, which is hypocrisy. And it's my observation that hypocrisy is one of the most serious problems in the world, in part because of the teaching example that it's offering, but also at the same time, there is an issue of the conflict between the stated message and the demonstrated message. And I think that that it's in some ways worse than someone, you know, preaching evil and being evil. At least you could see that there's some consistency between the preaching and the demonstration. But when someone is preaching wholesomeness and love and light and all that, and they are then acting in a way that is just negative and unloving, that's a very complicated mixed message. And I think that one of the reasons that it's so dangerous is that it makes people suspicious of anything positive, of anything affirming. When we see so often that people who, preach goodness in some way and then are busy doing exactly the opposite of what they teach, it tends to lower the trust level of anyone saying anything friendly. How do you know that person's not really a fraud? And it's complicated sometimes to get through this, but it is simpler if your own mission is clear and you're not in conflict with authority. That's kind of the trick to it all. Let's continue with this section of the teacher's manual in our, which is all, by the way, all of the text I've been reading is not from the textbook, but rather the volume, third volume called Manual for Teachers. This course remains within the ego framework, it says, where it is needed. It's not concerned with what is beyond all error because it is planned only to set the direction towards it. Therefore, it uses words, which are symbolic, and cannot express what lies behind the symbols. It is merely the ego that questions because it is the ego that doubts. So we might think of, in looking for a sane definition of the ego, we might think of it as a questioning, doubting thought form. Now, that said, it's important to have enough doubt to slow things down long enough to pause. As some Zen teaching I read a long time ago proposed, the doubt is like chewing your food to render it digestible. The problem with most doubt is that it's all about chewing and not about swallowing. So once someone has decided that no idea is acceptable, then that's just a lot of chewing. The course does not recognize as questions the mere form of a question to which an answer is impossible. Okay, this I think is one of the most transcendently brilliant bodies of knowledge in this work, which is about asking questions in a way that can be answered. Very important if you're involved in divination of any kind. And stating problems in a way that can be solved. Somewhere in the workbook, we'll get there eventually, is the lesson, let me recognize the problem so it can be solved. And in there, or at least I figured out from reading and working with it, is that it's essential to state problems in a way that can be solved. And you'll notice as you describe problems and you hear people describe problems, some times problems are described in ways where they are absolutely impossible to solve. And sometimes problems are stated in a way where there's a solution, and it's the same problem. We could easily do a thought experiment and pick problems, and based on the way we state the problem, see the ease or difficulty of matching a solution. So, the course does not recognize as questions the mere form of a question to which an answer is impossible. The ego may ask, how did the impossible occur? To what did the impossible happen? And may ask this in many forms. Yet there is no answer, only an experience. Seek only this and do not let theology delay you. And I would add to that, do not let psychology delay you either. These things are tools that are designed to get us someplace else. You will notice the emphasis on structural issues in the course is brief and early. Afterwards and soon, it drops away to make way for the central teaching. And since you've asked for a clarification, however, these are some of the terms used. I assume that the voice is speaking to Helen. I would recommend an interview with Kenneth Wapnick, which we posted to Edition 3. We'll post it to Edition 4 on the Planet Waves FM website. And this program is titled, by the way, Everyone Teaches and Teaches All the Time. So connected to that is the interview with Wapnick, where he talks about the dialogue between the scribe of the course, Helen Schuckman, and the source of the course, the voice of Jesus, coming through her. And he makes some very interesting clarifications, saying basically what you really are getting is Helen. There is an author to this, only the author was in a kind of a dialogue in her own mind with an entity that she was identifying in purely psychological terms as being within herself. But this entity had a name, and so forth. This is why it's important to not let theology or psychology delay you. The material pretty much stands on its own. I personally don't think anything should be accepted without a careful reading and consideration, but ultimately it is the experience that follows the reading, not even necessarily based on the reading itself, right? It's not necessarily, one thing I've been thinking about is, well, what influence did the Course in Miracles have on my life? And one way to consider that is to consider what happened to me in the months and years following encountering this material, having nothing to do with the material outwardly. But, you know, for example, I was working a journalism job the first year that I did the course. I was living at this place called Miracle Manor and had my first job as a journalist. And in the course of that year, met the editor of that newspaper who was an astrologer. And so I took a job as a journalist covering the sewer board, the township committee, but in the process met this person who gave me something that I have taken with me ever since. Just for example, I soon left the normal workforce and went into business for myself and have been independently employed since 1989. That alone is a kind of a testimony to how this material influenced me, because it was such a willing and potent influence. So experience here is it's a brilliant reminder, especially for a work that seems theologically, you know, to what did the impossible happen? We may ask this in many forms, yet there is no answer, only an experience. Seek only this experience, and do not let theology or psychology delay you. That's it for our program today. You may reach me at planetwaves.net. I'm a consultant of various kinds. I have some beautiful things I offer from my website, all of which are, I think, consistent with what I've learned doing A Course in Miracles. You may reach me personally anytime at efc@ericfrancis.com. I'll leave you with one more piece of music, that being Rain Dance. Catch you next week.